This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. We are celebrating Weed Week here at Reason, as are many other websites across the country, in anticipation of April 20th or 420, which is a Saturday. It's a day when all sorts of pot-related activities and seminars and ruminations will be happening across the nation. Now, when I want to discuss what's going on with drug policy and pot in particular, I turn to my Reason colleague, Jacob Solem, who's been writing about this topic for 30 years or more, and is contributing several pieces about pot this week at Reason.com, where we're celebrating our own version of Weed Week. If you go to Reason.com and look for Weed Week as a header, you'll be able to get a series of articles that are coming out over the course of the weekend, in anticipation of Saturday, April 20th. The author of the great book, Saying Yes in Defense of Drug Use, Jacob Solem, is the most equipped journalist, or pretty much activist, I would say. I'll ask him whether he agrees, to speak about the changing legal and cultural status of marijuana in America over the past few decades and where it's heading. And we're also going to discuss larger libertarian questions about questions of drug use and autonomy and responsible drug use. What does that mean? And is that possible, especially after 50 years or more of drug war propaganda saying that there is no such thing as responsible drug use, really only a drug abuse? So, Jacob, thanks for talking.
Sure.
All right. Well, let's talk about the pieces that you're rolling out for Weed Week at Reason.com first, and then we'll pull back and talk about some larger issues. But you've already published one piece at the website, which is called "Is Marijuana a Gateway to Opioids?" What did you find in your sortie into that question?
Well, if you look at all the research, what you find is that there is a clear correlation between marijuana use and use of other drugs, including opioids, but it's not clear what the correlation means. That's sort of the bottom line.
So, we're back to the gateway theory,
right?
Which is that if you try pot, then you end up going on to harder and harder drugs until you're, selling your shoes outside of a church or something like that for a final, death blow of heroin or something.
Yeah, I mean, the way that Harry Anslinger, who was the head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics back when marijuana was banned, up until the early 60s. The way he put it was that people would use marijuana until the thrill was gone, and then they needed something stronger to get them high.
Yeah.
And that the way he implied that if you continue using marijuana, it was almost inevitable that you'd become a heroin addict. So this was an element of anti-pop propaganda going way back, at least to the early 50s with Anslinger. I mean, prior to that, he was saying that marijuana would turn you into a murderer. Then he changed his tune and said, no, the real problem is it'll turn you into a heroin addict. So this all really predates any kind of systematic research into the question. But what the research has found is that, yes, people who use other drugs almost always, at least in the United States, use marijuana first. And yes, people who use marijuana are more likely than people who don't to use other drugs, including heroin.
But then you can take it back a step further, right? Because I'm assuming most people who use marijuana have also have drank alcohol.
Right.
Or
typically,
cigarettes.
The progression goes alcohol or tobacco or both, then marijuana, then other drugs. And the vast majority of people who use marijuana never use heroin, let alone become addicted to it. But there is an increased risk, an increased chance. And the question is that caused by the experience of using marijuana, or are there pre-existing differences between the people who like to use marijuana or are willing to experiment with marijuana and the people who don't that explain why they also might be more likely to use other drugs? And there's really no way to definitively answer the question unless you're going to, randomly divide a bunch of babies into two groups and have one be exposed to marijuana in early adolescence and the other one not, and then see how they turn out.
That would be a brave experiment, for sure.
You would have trouble getting approval from an institutional
I would only take,
I imagine.
Yeah, it should be Siamese twins, conjoined twins. That would be the only pure study, although I guess you'd have a lot of confounding variables.
Yeah, I mean, they actually,
contact eyes
they have done studies involving twins, but not, not randomly assigned twins. And so if you have a set of twins and one of them, typically what they do is they look at whether they use marijuana early, so before age 17 or before age 18, And how likely are they then to use other drugs compared to their twin, their co-twin, who did not use marijuana at an early age? And there is this increased risk. But then you have to ask yourself, how come one twin used marijuana at an early age and the other one didn't? Yeah. Whatever factors explain that might also explain the greater propensity to use other drugs. So it's really, you cannot come up with a definitive answer. But we can talk about what's plausible. And one of the things that people point out is that even if this association that we're talking about represents a cause and effect relationship, the implications for policy are not obvious, because one way that using marijuana could make you more likely to try other drugs is you've broken one drug law, therefore you're more inclined to break another one. You did it, you know, without suffering any serious consequences. You discover that what the government was saying about marijuana was bullshit, and now you assume that what they're saying about heroin is also bullshit. And then the third thing is, you have to go into the black market to buy marijuana. Therefore, you're more likely to encounter people who can also get other drugs. Well, all three of those things are connected to government policy. So the government did not have a policy of, first of all, banning marijuana. So you have to go into the black market and you have to break the law in order to get it. And secondly, you know, that they're putting it into the same category as heroin to begin with. Then secondly, lying about it. That's a matter of policy too, to exaggerate the harms caused by marijuana. If you didn't have those factors, then you would expect this correlation would be smaller if it existed at all. And there's some evidence of that. If you look at the Netherlands, where they've tolerated retail sales of marijuana since the 70s, and it looks like use of other drugs there is lower than you would otherwise expect it to be. So there's and that actually was one of the explicit motivations for that policy, was to separate the marijuana trade from the trade in other drugs. And it looks like that may have been successful there. So that's even assuming a causal relationship. We don't know the nature of the mechanism, and that also matters.
Well, let's talk about the other pieces you're going to be providing at Reason.com. One of them is about stone driving, driving while stoned, while high. Is it, and your story is about, is it dangerous, first off, and is it on the rise? Let's take that in turn. Is stone driving dangerous?
I would say it's not a smart thing to do. There's clear evidence,
and it's not a smart thing to do, apart from you might get arrested for driving.
Yes, it's not a smart or responsible thing to do, given the evidence about how marijuana affects abilities in the laboratory that are plausibly related to driving. So I would say that the strongest evidence that marijuana impairs driving ability comes from these controlled studies where they use simulators or sometimes driving courses. And they either compare people, the same person when they're stoned and when they're not stoned, or different people randomly assigned to get marijuana or placebo, and they look to see, you know, how does it actually affect their performance? And there is an effect. Now, the effect is much less dramatic than what you see with alcohol. And one of the things they find, first of all, marijuana doesn't affect as many abilities as dramatically. Secondly, people who are stoned tend to be more aware of their impairment than people who are drunk. And so they will tend to compensate for that impairment by driving more slowly, by being more careful. And so that, I mean, that's kind of
basically by acting like Cheech and
Chong. Yes, it's kind of a stereotype, but there's truth to it. Yeah. So those two things combined mean that whatever risk marijuana poses in the real world out on actual highways and roads is definitely not as big a risk as alcohol poses. But it doesn't mean it doesn't pose any risk at all.
Well, and also, how do we define stone driving? Because this is a serious policy question now that recreational pot is legal, and I guess actually with medical marijuana as well. What counts as being stoned while driving, and how are we figuring that out?
Yes, that's a real problem, because even if we assume that at some level marijuana is apt to impair your driving ability, the question becomes, how do we measure whether you've crossed that threshold? There is no way to do it based on THC in the blood, which is what some states have started to do. By analogizing it to alcohol, they say, well, with alcohol, if you're above a 0.08%, that's the standard in almost every state, except I think Utah. If you're above that, we're going to assume that you're impaired by alcohol. If you're below that, you're okay, although you might still be impaired. But
right, you have to pass a field sobriety test.
But it's a clear test, and there's good evidence behind it. It's not 100%, but there's good evidence correlating levels of alcohol in the blood with a level of impairment. There's no such good evidence when it comes to marijuana, largely because marijuana is fat soluble instead of water soluble. Mm-hmm. So the level of THC in your blood is not reflective of the level of THC in your brain. It may be absorbed into fatty tissue and then come out into your blood again later. And there's no clear correlation between THC blood levels and impairment. So that is not a good standard. And what will end up happening if you make that your standard, as they did in Washington State, they decreed if you have more than this amount of THC in your blood, we're going to presume that you're impaired. You're automatically guilty of driving while impaired, even if you're not impaired. And the problem is that regular users could be people who use it medically or could just be somebody who smokes every day. They may be perfectly capable of driving safely at levels far above this arbitrary cutoff. Conversely, people who are only occasional users or novice users may be in no shape to drive below that level.
So, we're also in a broader sense too. I mean, we're very much at the beginning stages of people even understanding, you know, I mean, having regular supply of kind of high quality pot, and then like how that affects them, right? I mean, in a way that you know, if you've been drinking for 20 years and, you know, on my third beer, I'm starting to kind of lose control or something like that,
right?
Or I'm getting fuzzy. You know, we really are barely scratching the surface with pot as part of everyday kind of intoxicant use.
Yes, and you can you can look up calculators for alcohol. It's not, again, not 100% precise, but it's a pretty good gauge of if I weigh this much, I'm a man, and I have, you know, this many units of alcohol, what will my blood alcohol level be?
Whereas, and if you're a sensitive man, you add an extra drink,
really,
right?
Or
take one away.
Yeah, there are variables like that, and I don't want to get into too much. But actually, you know, alcoholics are probably, you know, they're going to be the best prepared to drive while they're drunk. They have developed tolerance and they've gotten used to it. And so really, you know, if you're going to,
I really hope no children are listening.
If you're
going to
be strictly scientific about it, you would give the alcoholics extra leeway, a higher cutoff, but. Yeah. With alcohol, at least, you can say, if I've had so many beers in this amount of time on an empty stomach, whatever, I think I'm approximately this level, and I probably shouldn't drive. There's no such guide for cannabis consumers. They can't say, I've taken a couple of puffs from this thing, even knowing the THC content of it. I can predict that in an hour, this is going to be my, you know, I'm going to be above Washington's cutoff for driving under the influence of marijuana. There are now, I mean, I know of one app, I'm sure there are others, that measures your, it's aimed at measuring your impairment by comparing your performance on certain visual spatial tasks when you're sober. That's your baseline versus what you're able to do now. And that's really the best approach, is to look at
it. That's kind of great.
Yes.
So that's really fantastic.
So I think that's really going to be the way to go ultimately for the government trying to keep dangerously stoned people off the roads. Mm-hmm. You need some kind of test of impairment. And this is the tricky thing. Ideally, that incorporates information about somebody's baseline. Now, with a random driver that's been pulled over, you don't know their baseline. And you have people who fail sobriety tests who are perfectly sober. Just because of their inherent limitations. Their balance is not very good. Maybe they get super nervous. Maybe, you know, there's all kinds of, there's very wide variability in terms of health.
Oh, and every defense attorney in the country will tell you that field sobriety tests are completely kind of controlled by the officer. Okay. They can slip up anybody.
Well, that's a factor too, and also their perceptions, right? I mean, so one of the things I read about in this article is, you have a 12-step procedure that is performed by drug recognition experts. These are police officers who go through special training to administer this protocol, and it's supposed to be a measure of, not clear what it's a measure of. It's a measure of impairment, ideally, but really it's a way for them to predict what drug they think you've taken, assuming you've taken a drug at all. But when they perform this protocol, one of the first things they do is they talk to the arresting officer, the officer who pulled over the driver, and they talk to the driver. And so information that might have emerged at that early stage would include the guy, well, it might be he was driving erratically, the cop might report that. He had trouble finding his license and his insurance information. He didn't seem to understand instructions. He was kind of stumbling around. He smelled of pot. He had a big bag of pot on his front seat. He admitted to me that he had just smoked pot. Right. Yeah. So this is, or, you know, he actually,
I hate to say this, but right now I'm looking at the clock, and at least in the Eastern time zone, it's 4:20, Jacob. Yes. And I feel like you're high right now.
Well,
but
I kind of feel that way. Whenever I talk to you, I feel a little bit buzzed, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, the point is you get all this information, and it's not, the information is obviously relevant. It's relevant, but that is apt to affect the way that the officer later perceives the test results, right? So if he then does a sobriety test or does some of these other measurements, they include eye examinations and looking in the oral cavity and so on, to the extent that there's any wiggle room there, he is apt to perceive that person, more likely to perceive that person as stoned and as failing those tests than he would otherwise be.
So to sum up so far, stone driving is difficult to define, but it is dangerous. And then the question is it on the rise?
That's also hard to answer, because what they typically are looking at is who tests positive among drivers involved, typically in fatal crashes they're looking at. So driver involved in a fatal crash, you test his blood, and testing positive could mean some THC or could mean an inactive metabolite of THC. As we mentioned already, people can have THC in their blood without actually being under the influence or impaired. So the fact that there's THC even the THC in their blood doesn't mean that they were impaired at the time of the crash or that marijuana contributed to.
Because what they're finding in the blood, the metabolite sticks around for, is it weeks?
If you're a heavy user. Yeah. Oh, the metabolite, yes, you could detect for a long time. But even THC in a heavy user could be detected for days or maybe even a week. Mm-hmm. After they stopped using, because it's stored in fatty tissue and may come out again, but it doesn't mean that they are impaired. So what you will see in any population where adult use of marijuana is going up, as it has in Colorado, for example, you would expect to see more drivers testing positive for THC, just because more people in general are using marijuana. It doesn't necessarily mean that crashes caused by marijuana are on the rise. And what you're really interested in is, overall, are fatal crashes, are there more fatalities than you would otherwise expect? That's the crucial question. Because there are also another issue which we alluded to but did not explicitly say, was that to the extent that marijuana is a substitute for alcohol, and that's an open question, but assuming that people getting stoned are less likely to be drinking as opposed to be doing both at the same time, there is some trade-off there, you could actually see a positive effect on road safety to the extent that you get high drivers out of the road rather than drunk drivers.
So
the question, just to finish the point, is that there really is, at this point, there is no evidence in states that have legalized that the number of traffic fatalities is higher than you would otherwise expect.
Mm-hmm. And I guess we're also, you know, kind of mucking up the variables here too, is the rise of ride sharing and whatnot. So that, I mean, because I assume, I actually don't know, are drunk driving arrests going down in general because of things like Uber and Lyft?
Oh, I don't know about that. It sounds plausible.
But who knows?
But the point, and when they do these studies, what they do a simulation where they're comparing states that have legalized to a sort of artificial sample of comparison states. Mm-hmm. They're saying, suppose Colorado had not legalized. What would you have expected to happen if that hadn't legalized, if the trends had continued as they were, and then what is actually happening? So that's the standard they're using, and what they're finding is that there does not seem to be an increase in fatalities.
Well, that's good news, right? So let's keep it quiet. You also have for a guy who writes a lot about weed and probably is, you know, smoking all the time, you write a lot, but you also are doing a roundup of places that are still really draconian in terms of marijuana laws, even as, you know, other places it's totally legal. What did you find there? What's going on?
Well, I mean, the first thing to note when I start the piece with is that there are actually people serving life sentences for marijuana, nonviolent marijuana offenses. I mean, unusual.
For dealing. Is it for dealing or is it for merely possession?
Yes, it's typically for growing or smuggling or, you know, distributing.
Yeah.
But especially at the federal level, once you hit a certain cutoff, and this is the crucial part, if you have two previous drug felony convictions, even if they were not violent, that's a life sentence, a mandatory life sentence.
Yeah. Wow.
Yes. So there are such people, and it's kind of amazing because what they are serving life sentences for is legal in a bunch of states now. People are making, you know, lots of money from it, and they're sitting in prison. So that's the extreme, right? But even without considering those cases, you've got to be careful, you know, to consider the law and the level of enforcement in the state you happen to be in. I suspected that Texas would be among like the most punitive states, but it's not quite the most punitive. Places like Georgia and Florida actually have more severe penalties. These are places where you can, at least in theory, still go get arrested and get a jail sentence for the tiniest amounts,
for possession.
Tiniest amounts of marijuana. Even if you would say it's personal possession, it doesn't matter. Whether people, that often happens is another question, but in theory, at least, you can go to jail in a bunch of states for up to a year just for small amounts, possessing small amounts of marijuana. There's a weird wrinkle in Texas where hash or cannabis concentrates in general are treated much more severely than weed, than flowers. So there was one case that I blogged about a few years ago where this kid had, I think it was a pound and a half of hash. Well, it was really, you know, marijuana concentrate, brownies and and cookies, and they count the entire weight as if that was the concentrate. So he was facing theoretically, you know, like 10 years to a life sentence based on the initial charges. So, I mean, who would have thought that? You wouldn't guess that having, you know, a pound and a half of baked goods spiked with marijuana could get you that kind of sentence. You know, so you have to be aware of what's going on and plan accordingly.
Which state do you think will be the first like Southern state to fully legalize?
Southern.
You know, cause it seems as if, you know, the Southern states, the former Confederacy, is the least likely.
I would say that that among the last would be states like Oklahoma and Utah. I could see Texas happening, actually. I mean, I would not have said that until a few years ago, but there is a kind of libertarian sentiment. There have been bills introduced in the state.
Whereas Oklahoma and I guess Mississippi maintained alcohol prohibition for decades after it was.
Utah also had alcohol prohibition. Yeah. That's amazing. So, but I wouldn't, you know, I mean, I'm just trying to think, is there anybody that's more likely than Texas that's considered to be the South? Florida, no, I wouldn't say necessarily, although they do, you know, look, Florida, well, they have the initiative process, so that helped. But in Florida, they have medical marijuana, which in Texas, medical marijuana is limited just to cannabidiol extracts for treating epilepsy. But at least that actually got off the ground, which surprised me. There actually are state licensed providers of CBD oil for treatment of epilepsy in Texas. Mm-hmm. So who knows?
What are the trends in use rates in places that have legalized pot for recreational use? I mean, is there a predictable percentage by which people become regular users, or is it kind of scattershot, or are there not particularly clear trends yet?
I think adult use goes up, generally speaking. That includes more people using, but also people who are already using more often. What the surprising thing to me was that underage use so far is not going up. Yeah. Maybe it's not surprising, but I figured, you know, a lot of people, a lot of advocates of legalization sort of dismissed the idea that underage use would go up. They would say, look, kids can already buy it. Nobody, you know, black market dealers don't card them. They don't care how old you are, which is true. And it also is true that, if you go to a state like Colorado or Washington or Nevada or California, go to a dispensary, they are very serious about enforcing this 21 or older purchase age. But you still have a legal market among people 21 or older, and you would expect there to be some leakage from that, right? So if you're 18 or 17, you've got a brother who's 21, well, how hard is it going to be for you to get pot? I mean, the same way that there's leakage from the alcohol market, you would expect that sort of thing to happen.
But that doesn't seem to be happening.
At least it doesn't seem to be happening to the extent that it I guess, outweighs the impact on the black market. To the extent that the black market has been undermined, and the argument has always been, if you undermine the black market where nobody cards customers, you make it harder for kids to have direct access, at least to. And that's true. It's harder to get direct access because the retailers in a legal market are much more careful.
What is what's going on by age or generation? Because if I'm recalling right, and I haven't looked at the numbers recently, but you know, basically almost every vice, you know, whether it was sex, drugs, or, and I suppose rock and roll at this point, all peaked in the late 70s or early 80s among younger people. And then there's been decline since then, some upticks, et cetera. But what, you know, what is a 25-year-old now, how likely are they to be using pot on a regular basis? And is that percentage going up or down?
The percentage has gone up overall in the last couple of decades pretty substantially, especially among young adults.
But is it still below the peaks of the late 70s, early 80s?
Yes. Well, at least among it's hard for older adults. I'm not sure that we've got comparable data, but the one data set that is, that goes back to the 70s for sure is a poll of high school students.
Right. That's the Monitoring the Future study.
Right. Yeah. And in that one, yes, you're right. The levels of marijuana use peaked around 1979. And, you know, in terms of high school, you know, high school seniors using pot. So there does seem to be this sort of divergence between teenagers and young adults, similar to what you're seeing in the states that have legalized.
What do you give any credence to a number of you know, articles or studies or people who say, you know, one of the problems with contemporary marijuana is, first off, it is much, it's much higher quality. It tends to have, you know, higher levels of THC in it, but that for young people, particularly young boys or young men whose brains aren't fully developed, et cetera, that heavy, chronic heavy use in your teenage years or whatever is really dangerous in a way that has not been captured by the way that we talk about pot and a kind of pro-legalization mentality.
That it's gotten more dangerous because it's more potent, you mean?
Yeah, or and that it's more common for if a kid who is smoking weed every day now, say who's 18 or 19, they're going to be more, it has the potential to really disrupt their final brain development in a way that maybe 30 years ago, it wasn't such a big deal because it wasn't that high a level or something.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't dismiss the concern. Whenever you're looking at the impact of adolescent drug use in general, but marijuana use in this case, it's hard to disentangle cause and effect because it's not probably regardless of whether it has long lasting effects on your brain, it's probably not a good idea for, you know, a high school student to be stoned all day, every day. You know, it's going to affect, you know, his interactions with other people, how well he learns the stuff he's supposed to learn and so on. And you also have to wonder, why is he doing that? Right. So what is he trying to escape something? Is he have other problems that are causing him to want to be sort of numbed all the time? So it's hard to disentangle all of that. In terms of greater potency creating greater problems, there's probably something to that. If you are used to the shitty weed that we had when we were younger, and you try, I remember the first time I tried a pot in Amsterdam, where they had some, what to me at that time were very potent strains.
Yeah. And it was but even now you realize that was like, you know, if American weed was like Miller Lite or something, the Amsterdam stuff you were looking at, it was like a Molson Canadian. It wasn't like actually good pot, but it was much better than what you thought.
It seemed and quite, now it's quite potent to me, and like a few puffs were plenty. And then when I went to, you know, Colorado when they legalized, they had this strain called Butterface. Where I don't know what if it's supposed to be like 28% or once you get above 20% THC, it's, you know, it's pretty strong. But this was the kind of thing where I was trying to do an interview. I was with this guy who runs a like a marijuana, I don't know if he still does this, but he was running a marijuana themed like tourism business. And because there's almost no place in Colorado where visitors can legally use the cannabis they can legally buy, his niche was to provide these limos that would take you around from one dispensary to another. And it's a nice trip. You go up into the, you know, the mountains near Denver, and you stop.
So it's like a pub crawl.
Yeah, you stop at various. And his reading of law, which I think was correct, was that in the passenger compartment, it's okay to do what you want to do. It's a private car for hire. It's not a public, what the government would consider to be a public place. And so, but I was, I recorded this whole thing, but if you listen to the recording at a certain point after just a puff or so of the butterface, I just, the conversation trails off and you don't hear much except random comments after that. So yes, there's a difference and you do have to be careful. You got to be aware of what you're consuming. I would say, I mean, the upside is, if people are going to smoke, which really they shouldn't, they should just vape, and you know that mm-hmm. avoids the combustion issue. But if you're going to be smoking, in terms of respiratory health effects, you're better off with stronger pot because you only have to take a puff or two or three, and you're not inhaling nearly as much smoke. So that's the one health benefit. And I think, I mean, there is evidence that people, they want to be a certain amount of high, like they don't want to be totally obliterated. And you know, the same thing with, if you compare whiskey to beer, it's a similar kind of thing. Mm-hmm. People are aware that, you know, whiskey is stronger than beer and they're not going to gulp as much whiskey as they would beer in an evening. And so there's a similar thing happening with marijuana, especially if you're smoking or vaping and you're very quickly aware of the effects. I think, people, they may make mistakes, but they're less likely to make mistakes when they get, you know, very quick feedback. And so they're aware of how stoned they're getting. And most people don't want to be so stoned that they can't have a conversation or can't enjoy what's going on around them. And they just kind of fall asleep. So there is some, you know, people can be trained to take into account how potent marijuana is. And, you know, the trickier thing I think was with the edibles, where it takes so long to take effect and people have trouble predicting exactly how stoned they're going to be, and they tend to take more when they probably shouldn't. And you know that, to me, I don't really understand why those are so appealing, except for people who just don't want to be sucking anything into their lungs, whether it's vapor or smoke. But it seems much iffier to me. But even with that, there's a learning curve, and you can figure out, well, if I take this one square of chocolate, my experience tells me, you know, on an empty stomach, let's say, my experience tells me that in an hour I'm going to feel pretty good. I don't need to take the second square or whatever it is. I mean, some people might be two squares or three squares. So people, there is a learning curve, and you may remember when these dispensaries started to open in Colorado and Washington, there were these stories, or there was a famous story, but what's your name? New York Times column.
Maureen Dowd.
I ate too much of this, you know, cannabis chocolate bar, and I freaked out. Yeah. Maureen Dowd, right. Yeah. And it's like, well, yes. That's because you had too much, you know, and you know, there are, you know, a good bud tenders will warn you about this sort of thing and be aware that it can take a long time. It can take 2 hours in my experience. You know, so that's a long time to be waiting for somebody to come on. It takes a lot of planning to predict, you know, how high you want to be in two hours.
Right.
So, but you know, these are things that people can learn.
If what you were obviously in the early stages of the 2020 election, in terms of presidential candidates, which ones are the best on pot and drug policy more generally?
I guess we're talking about the Democrats.
Yeah, well, and Trump as well, and Trump and Bill Weld. Yeah.
Honestly, I think at this point, I think everybody is pretty much on board with letting the states do what they want to do. I mean, mm-hmm. Trump is on record as saying that. Since when he ran for president and then since being elected, he has said that he's inclined to support one of the bills that would basically repeal the federal ban with respect to conduct that's legal under state mm-hmm. law, right?
Right.
So he's on board with that, even though he's not so keen on legalizing marijuana. All the Democrats are on board with that, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not sure Joe Biden has specifically addressed that.
Yeah, and but he apparently he was recently at an anti-drug conference, and obviously has a long and bloody history as a drug warrior. And he seemed to be he didn't speak directly to the issue, but he seemed to be supporting people who were saying we need to hold the line on marijuana. But
it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, he was a very gung-ho drug warrior going way back. And he's made a couple of half-hearted apologies, but I haven't heard much of anything specific on marijuana policy. But I think otherwise the Democrats are on board. I mean, some of them more recently than others. Kamala Harris came on board a year ago, you know, is when she first started talking about legalizing marijuana at the federal level. And before,
and also then more recently bragging about smoking weed.
Herself
in college, so, you know, which is, you know, there's going to be a lot of that going on.
Yeah, well, it's like, oh, yeah. Look, she's my age. And if you look at the poll, at the survey data, especially if you allow for a little bit of underreporting, which there certainly is, this is the typical experience of somebody our age, that you did this in high school, you did it in college, or you did it in both places. Your friends did it. Nobody, you know, nobody's lives were destroyed by it unless they have to get arrested.
I don't know. You know, maybe she'd already be president.
And when she did that interview, did you watch the video of that?
Yes.
She's so proud of herself that she's being so honest. Yeah. She says something like, oh, I broke loose. It's like, please. Yeah. You know, this is even, you know, years ago, like, in the early 2000s or earlier, back in the 90s, Democrats were admitting, you know, that as in their youth, they did this.
Michael Bloomberg, who was like nobody's idea of a sybaritic pleasure seeker, at least, you know, in terms of public policy, admitted that he smoked weed and, you know, inhaled.
Right.
And that was all of that.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, since Clinton and that like embarrassingly weaselly response, people have been riffing off of that, maybe Obama most memorably. So there's nothing. You don't get any credit for that, to my mind, for admitting.
And actually, and you probably get a lot of, you should get a lot of demerits because Kamala Harris was a drug warrior as a prosecutor and as an attorney general.
She was against legalization in California.
Yeah.
And then later just declined to take a position. Sort of laughed off, not sort of, literally laughed at the issue. So the only thing that impressed me honestly about that interview, which I actually wrote about, was that. She talked about how that marijuana should be legalized because we need more joy in life. And I liked that because it's, you know, this is somebody admitting that that fun is important, that recreation is important, that it shouldn't be dismissed as something that trivial, right? Which people tend to do. So that aspect of it, I like. The other stuff, not so much.
In California, which obviously is the largest state to have, you know, fully embraced legal recreational pot, but has completely screwed up the implementation, is that going to get better under Governor Gavin Newsom, or is it just going to kind of sludge on to something less than optimal?
I think it kind of has to get better. I mean, if they want to actually displace the black market, which is sort of the point. If you legalize marijuana and it is more expensive than black market marijuana, you're doing something wrong. And if that situation persists for years and years, then you're going to have a problem because you're going to continue to have a black market. You're not going to get, in their minds, they want tax revenue from this. But instead of setting the rate very low or at zero to begin with, and then, you know, waiting for the legal industry to establish itself and to displace the black market, and then maybe raising taxes. They hit it with very high taxes to begin with, which in some, you know, they is a combination of standard sales tax, special sales taxes at the state and local level, and it can add as much as 45% to the cost. And then on top of that, you have all these regulations you have to deal with as a regulated marijuana producer or merchant in California. You've got to deal with regulations at the state level and at the local level. And the black market dealers don't pay the taxes and they don't have to deal with those regulations. So, of course, they have an advantage right now. Now, there's some indication that legislators are figuring this out. There was a bill that was introduced, I think it was earlier this year, that would temporarily reduce the marijuana taxes to help the new industry get off its feet or get onto its feet. I guess that's the expression. Nice. I don't think it's enough. I mean, it's a small reduction and it doesn't go nearly as far as they really need to go. But they're going to have to do something. Now, I think the situation has improved. You know, Colorado and Washington both had some problems initially where, you know, most of the marijuana was still being bought on the black market. It's not true anymore in Colorado. I don't think it's true in Washington either. So it's not like the situation has to last forever. But, I mean, it's just common sense that when you're trying to get something like this off the ground, you have to be mindful of all the burdens that are imposed on these legal businesses that the black market dealers don't have to deal with, both the tax burden and the regulatory burden. And then you also have these problems under federal law where you can't you know, aside from the fact that you can be arrested and go to prison any day and have all your property seized, in addition to that, you can't even file taxes the regular way. You can't claim your business right. expenses. That's a huge burden. Imagine that if you're running a business, you've got all these taxes, all these state and local regulations. Plus, when you file your income taxes, you can't deduct most of your business expenses, except for...
Yeah, your Schedule C is really going to be...
Yes, it's then, really... Right? I mean, it's yeah. a tremendous burden. So this stuff, I'm hoping, will eventually get ironed out.
Well, let's talk about that as a final question. What you know, we're on course to fully legalize weed sooner or later at the national level. What are the next big things that have to happen? And are they... I mean, not necessarily specifically political or you know, new laws being passed, but is there... You know, are there events that might happen or things that would push forward the timeline for legalization?
I'm really bad at predicting this stuff. I didn't think that most of this would be happening this soon. Mm-hmm. So you should take what I say with a grain of salt. But it looks to me like...
Or with a couple of kilos Butterface.
I would say a bowl of it, but that's way too much. a puff or two of Butterface at the most. But... It looks to me like there will be federal legislation sometime within the decade, you know, within the next several years, addressing the conflict between state and federal law. Because this is, I mean, the Attorney General, who's no fan of legalization, has said this is just untenable. He's also said he has no intention to crack down on state licensed marijuana businesses, but Congress needs to do something. And so they're going to have to pass a law that addresses the criminal exposure, that addresses the banking issue. It's another thing, right? Banks do not want to serve these businesses because they're based on committing federal felonies every day. The banking issue, the tax issue. And the cleanest way to do that is just to remove marijuana from Schedule One. So it's not federally banned anymore. And then now states can still choose to continue banning it. And in which case the federal government might help them, you know, to stop smuggling from other states where it's legal, that sort of thing. But the federal government would not be trying to enforce a ban on marijuana in states that have rejected that ban. And
I assume that there are also events then that could really delay things. So if we get the equivalent of a kind of Len Bias cocaine death, the University of Maryland basketball player who helped trigger a whole new round of harsher drug laws back in the 80s, something like that could forestall this for a while.
Yes, although it's hard to imagine what that would be. I wouldn't rule it out. I think what you are seeing is that you had a bunch of states that did this by initiative, and we're starting to run out of states that have the initiative process. So there are only so many states that I forget the exact number, but in other states like New Jersey and New York, this has to move through the state legislature. And both of those places, it looked like it was happening this year, but it sort of fell through. So there will be, I think, false starts like that when you have to count on legislators actually voting for legalization at the state level. It may not happen as quickly as people were hoping. But it's here to stay. It's not going to be reversed. There will have to be some kind of accommodation between federal law and what the states are doing.
Won't it be kind of disturbing if both Canada has already legalized marijuana and if Mexico gets to it before we do, which it could happen, that we would be the last member of the old NAFTA union to actually legalize weed?
Yes, the last bastion of pot prohibition in North America. Yes, I mean, it's not impossible that would happen. I think we can learn some things from Canada. I think they learned some things from us. Their taxes are not quite as high as they might have been, so they're aware of that. They also set their purchase age lower, which I think, notwithstanding these concerns about brain development and all that, which I don't want to get into detail on that, but I think it is a huge mistake to criminalize the age groups that are most likely to want to consume this product. I mean, if you, the same thing with alcohol, if you set the drinking age so high that most college students are drinking illegally, that is not conducive to responsible, you know, developing a culture of responsible drinking, and it encourages abuse in various ways by pushing it underground. So I think that, and, you know, and you're criminalizing people, you're criminalizing adults. They are adults, but you've decided for purposes of marijuana and purposes of alcohol in the U.S., they're not. A candidate took the route of saying whatever the alcohol age is, and it's typically 18 or 19, it varies a bit by province, that's going to be the marijuana age.
As a final point, can you describe the and you talk about this in saying yes in defense of drug use. You talk about responsible drug use. What is the shorthand definition of responsible drug use?
Well, I mean, it's pretty commonsensical. You don't use drugs in a way that is going to expose others to harm or to danger. You know, so to driving while you're stoned or drunk would be an example of that. You have to meet your responsibilities. So you don't go to work stoned unless, I mean, it depends on your job, I suppose. But for most jobs, you don't want to go to work stoned if you're a pilot or, you know, a surgeon, that sort of thing, especially.
Obviously in that limousine in Colorado, you defied all journalistic convention and you got too close to the story.
Yes. Well, that's a good example because that, you know, was not very conducive. I mean, I'm not sure how productive that interview would have been anyway, but it was not too conducive, but I was, you know, it was research too. So it was a kind of a mix of research and recreation, but yes. So that's, I mean, it's, you know, you have to keep a certain balance in your life. You don't want to, there are lots of things that bring us pleasure. Some people do those things to excess in a way that interferes with their lives, hurts their relationships with other people, affects their ability to be productive, endangers other people, right? These are all kind of irresponsible behaviors, and it doesn't really matter whether the thing happens to be legal or illegal. You have to find a way to, you know, not go overboard and to do things in moderation and responsibly. I don't think, I mean, that's a notion that I think it is acceptable to almost everyone, at least when it comes to certain things. So alcohol would be a good example. Eating, right, is another example. Sex, exercise, video, you know, playing video games, and, you know, anything that could be done to excess. People typically manage to keep a handle on it.
All right. Well, that we're going to leave it there. Thank you, Jacob Sullum, for discussing responsible drug use and the current state of marijuana prohibition and liberation. We've been talking. This has been the Reason Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. At Reason.com, we're doing a whole series of Weed Week stories. Go look for them at Reason.com, especially Jacob's pieces. Jacob, thanks for talking.
Sure. Thank you.
And for the audience, thanks for listening. Please, if you like what you hear, subscribe to us at Apple Podcasts, at Google, at Spotify, at Reason.com, anywhere you get your podcasts on. Thanks for listening.